This is the start of the July 26, 1986 interview with Geraldine Marjoram and her son John Gavagan Jr. The interview was conducted at John Gavagan's home at 2027 Acacia Road, Neptune Beach, Florida. The interviewer is David Taylor, and the interview is conducted in connection with the Maritime Heritage Survey Project. This is tape one of three tapes.
Margin a bottle of rum, put it together and say it in a hurry. Marge rum. Sounds like a mouthful, doesn't it?
Yeah. What was your maiden name?
Geraldine Elizabeth Cox. I was named after someone you've never heard of, yeah. An opera singer named Geraldine Farrar. My mother named me that because Mama liked music of all kinds, just like I do. I've always loved music. I like opera, classical, semi-classical, even down to the old hoedown hillbilly. I really do. The only thing I don't particularly like is this rock and roll, that kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. I'm not against it, but I just don't care for it.
Yeah. Now tell me a little bit where you grew up, and when were you born to begin with?
I was born in Wake County, North Carolina, in April 11th, 1919. I was born in the town that Margaret Truman's husband was from, E.C. Daniel. Mm-hmm. And I knew E.C. As a matter of fact, when I was in first grade, I had a big old crush on him because his father owned the drugstore. And I loved Eskimo pies. And my first Eskimo pie came from E.C.'s father's drugstore, Mr. Cliff, we called him. Mm-hmm. Mr. Cliff had eyes like a panda. You know, the ones with the dark shadows under them? That's the way Mr. Cliff, and E.C. was great. He was good looking. I'm not kidding you.
Mm-hmm. Now, he went on to be the editor or the publisher of the New York Times,
Yes, right? Indeed. Yes, sir. He was smart. He was a whiz kid, I'll tell you, even back then. Me just being in first grade. But then, from the time my mother died when I was 4 years old, my oldest sister was a school teacher, and I lived with her for a while in Pine Ridge, North Carolina. She taught three grades in one room, first, second, and third. Well, then I lived with a cousin. I lived with an aunt. But at age 10, I went to live with my beloved sister, Bert. She and her husband took me in. I was the baby of my family. My red-headed brother was what we called the knee baby. And she took Red in, and then when my sister Christine graduated from high school, she took her in. And I don't remember a day of my life after I went to live with Bert and Dick without feeling loved, just like a mother would. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Dick made us feel wanted. Every bit of good I've got in me today, I attribute every bit of it to Bert and Dick, the way they raised me. Mm-hmm. I went to Sunday school. I was ornery. Red and I both were. But we grew up to laugh, and that's what helped me survive the Donald Ray tragedy. Mm-hmm. The fact that I could laugh. We got fun out of so many things. We had a little dog. We named him Whiskey because mm-hmm. it did us so much good to tell everybody we had whiskey running all over the floor. Now, in North Carolina, you can imagine what that meant, even though we lived in town.
Yeah.
But where I lived, the bankers had gardens in back of their house, which we had one too. Mm-hmm. And then I had a very foolish marriage at age 18. I wasn't old enough to even know what marriage was, but I got a beautiful daughter out of that marriage. At age 20, I came to Florida to get over a heartache of that marriage. And I met John in 1941, and we got married in 1942.
How did you happen to come to this part of Florida?
I came with some friends from Jacksonville. The lady's husband was a musician, and they had a little girl, and they more or less needed a babysitter, too. Mm-hmm. And I that was in Jacksonville. I lived in Jacksonville for a while, and I didn't like Jacksonville too much. I had never lived in a big place, and it was big even then. So I came to the beach a couple times, and I kind of liked it. I started working at a drive-in on the ocean front right now across, you know, Neptune Beach is on this side of the street and Atlantic Beach over here. And right at the end of Neptune Beach before you hit the ocean, they had a pig stand, as they called it back then there, and I worked there.
What was a pig stand? I've never heard that before.
Where you go and can get car service for a sandwich, Coke, etc.
Yeah.
And this is so funny, too. Don't you do any of this you don't want to, but
sure.
I had a chip on each shoulder then. I couldn't help it after going through a very hurtful marriage.
Yeah.
And I was working the day shift. Well, we had stools for people to sit outside that wanted to get out of their cars, you know. Back then, you didn't have little cubes of sugar or little packs of sugar. You had it in a bowl. You didn't have little containers of cream. You had it in a pitcher.
Mm-hmm.
So we kept the cream and the sugar in the ice box. And I could always spot what I called a Georgia crack. I could spot them a mile off. And here come this man one morning, and he sat at the counter. It was about 10:30, 11 o'clock in the morning. I said, "Yes, sir, may I help you?" He said, "I'd like a cup of coffee." I said, "Yes, sir, how would you like your coffee?" He says, "Well, I tell you, I like my coffee like I like my women, strong and hot." And I looked at him, I said, "I guess you want it black too, don't you, sir?" And my boss, the girl that hired me, she had to go home and change clothes because it tickled her so much. As God is my witness, Grace had to go change her clothes. And that's just the way I was then.
Yeah.
And the night I met John, believe it or not, we kept our tips in a jar sitting on the counter. And someone came up and took my tips, and I can't remember whether they got any of the other girls or not. And John and a bunch of cars went looking for whoever did it. They didn't find them. And I'd started dating him after that night. And I really thought a lot of him, but I didn't have my divorce.
Mm-hmm.
And right after I got my divorce, he and I got married. And he was working for the government engineers at that time.
Mm-hmm.
We lived in Delray Beach until he got drafted. So I went to Oxford, like I told you, Oxford, North Carolina. I figured that was the best place for a young girl doing World War II. And believe it or not, we put one over on the Army because they sent him 80 miles from my home up in Virginia.
Yeah.
Gosh, I've forgotten the name of the place. But it was 80 miles from my home, so I did get to go see him. As a matter of fact, we had to stay in what they call guest houses.
Mm-hmm.
And they wouldn't let you stay but so long because there were so many wives that wanted to come and visit. But I know he got KP duty for sneaking around to see me, but you know what? They let me come help him peel potatoes. Someone took a picture of it. I did have that picture, and I don't know whether some of my children have it now or not, but they let me help him peel potatoes. Well, I saw him. He came home for Christmas of that year to North Carolina, and I think he left about January or February for New Guinea. He was over in New Guinea for 27 months.
Mm-hmm.
And another thing that happened while he was over in New Guinea, this to me is kind of interesting, but you can imagine being in the jungles of New Guinea. He was in maintenance, engineer maintenance,
mm-hmm.
and a tractor pulled up one day needing some work done on it, and guess who was driving the tractor? His first cousin from Jacksonville Beach, Moe Storms.
How about that?
Yes, indeed, boy, over in New Guinea. He came home, as I say, in May of 1945, and we stayed at my home for a while, and then we came to his mother and daddy's for him to see them. Well, he had to go back. He had to go to Fort Benning, I think in June of 45. And he got out in September of 1945, and we went to Mayport to live. We lived in one of his mother's apartments right across the street from her. And I guess if John had lived, in my heart, I feel like I'd still be married to him today.
Mm-hmm.
But I prayed when he was lost, "Lord, please send someone to help me raise these children. They need someone besides me." and I knew that. Because you figure now, I had them like doorsteps. My oldest girl, by my first marriage, she was married. As a matter of fact, she walked in that day with a birthday cake she had made for Kevin. Because it happened, the last day we know John was alive was on his fifth birthday. And Shelley was 18 months old. Kevin was 4, going on 5. Jimmy was 7. Debbie was 7. Gotta get it straight. Jimmy was 9, and John was 10. And that's how close we had those 5 children. And I guess if John had lived, we'd have probably had some more. I don't know, because we love children. My Gavigan boys were the first Gavigans born since John. John was 25 when John Jr. was born.
Had his family, the Gavigans, lived in Mayport for some time?
Mr. Gavigan, they got married in 1905. Mrs. Gavigan lived in New Berlin, which is across the river. Her father, Mr. Gordon, was one of the first bar pilots. And they made good money back in those days for that kind of work. And they bought several places there, in some land in Mayport. As a matter of fact, they bought land here at the beach. Where they made the biggest mistake in the world, Mr. Arthur Penman, who developed Penman Road, offered to sell them lots on Penman Road for $350. Way back then, and Miss Jeanette says, "No, Jim," and they could have. And you know those lots are really up there today. But I lived in Mayport, like I say, until 59, and we'd probably still be there now. Maybe the Gavigan Homestead would still be there. They tore it down when Mrs. Gavigan died. Mr. Gavigan died before John was lost, which to me, I thank the Lord many a time, because I don't think he could have taken that. He loved all of his children.
You were telling me before we started the machine here that John's father was a judge here?
He was just of the peace. They called him Judge Gavigan. He was the just of the peace longer than anyone else in Florida at that time, I think for about 33 years. He was just of the peace.
What was his territory or jurisdiction then?
Well, I believe it was about halfway between here and Jackson, but he would hold court in Atlantic Beach. He would hold court in Mayport. He would hold court in Neptune Beach. He would hold court in Jacksonville Beach. A just of the peace court. And he was very well liked. I remember when he passed away, the ex-governor, Fuller Warren, I'm sure you've heard of him, he was at his funeral. And I met Mr. Gavigan made me register. I had never registered to vote, and he was Mr. Democrat, just like Claude Papa. Excuse me.
Watch out now. We got that. Okay.
Now, what were we talking about?
We were just talking about the Justice of the Peace.
Mr. Gavigan. Well, like I say, he would hold court in Mayport, all three beaches areas. I remember Sleazy Woman, I shouldn't even say that. One of the women that followed the fleet from Fort Myers came to Mayport one time, and the sad part, I liked her. I don't care what she was. She came to see, Shelley had just been born, and she came by to see her. Her name was Gertie. I remember she was at one of the dives in Mayport, and she was 2 or 3 sheets in the wind. And the constable walked in, and she didn't know it was him, and she threw him out the door. Anyhow, Gertie came to town, to Mayport. Usually her stomping ground was Fort Myers Beach. And when Mr. Brunson, the constable, Mr. Frank Brunson, walked in the door of the jug joint, she threw him out. Well, guess where Gertie went? To jail.
I'll bet you.
Here the next morning, here comes Chichimo. You've heard of him, haven't you?
No, I haven't.
They haven't told you about Chichimo in Mayport. Lord, he's dead and gone, too. Chichimo had a monkey named Bosco. But anyhow, here come Chichimo and a couple of the other shrimpers, and they told me, says, Gertie's in jail, and we want you to talk to the judge. And says, we've collected. They had a hat that had some money in it, and I don't remember how much, but I say $30. and said, we know he's going to fine her. Says, and this is all the money we could get together. And said, Jerry, see if you can't talk to the judge and make him, ask him to make it easy on her. Well, anyhow, I had never done such as that in my life, but I did go over there because I didn't want to see that poor lost soul in jail. I really didn't. And I went over and I talked to him. Well, they went to court. He knew exactly how much money the men had. That's what he fined her, but he told her. He says, if you are in Mayport again, you will be picked up and put in jail immediately, and this time it won't go as easy on you. Lo and behold, 1 hour after court, I'm headed out of Mayport, and who do I see coming in towards Mayport but Gertie? I blew the car horn, and Mayport Road then wasn't like it is now, so she turned around and come behind me, and I run up. I says, where are you going? She said, Jerry, I had to come and thank you. I said, Gertie, don't you know you'll be put in jail? I said, you didn't have to do that. But I headed her back out again, and I was glad of that. I figured I owed her one because I was the cause of her getting put in jail in Fort Myers.
Oh, yeah.
I went to meet John when he came back from Camp Peachy Banks one time, and I'd heard them mention Gertie. Well, that day after we went out to get some lunch, and then we went to a bar, which those shrimpers work hard, but they play hard. And these two women were sitting there, and they spoke to him. And, of course, I was very jealous of him, which he was jealous of me. And even though I was the mother, I think of, that was in 55, I believe. Anyhow, I was the mother of several. He still was jealous of me, but I was jealous of him. And, of course, I said, who are they? And he tried to tell me that he wouldn't tell me it was Gertie, because he knew I'd heard about her. And he wouldn't have, because Gertie wasn't much to look at. But anyhow, we go and have something to eat, and then he took me out and bought me a dress. He wanted me to have a pretty dress. We go back to the hotel, and he was so tired because they run night and day coming from Camp Peachy. Well, he went to sleep real early, and that stinking phone rang about 7:30 that night, and it was a girl, and she said that her name was Louise. And she wanted to know if John was there. I says, he certainly is, but he's asleep, and I don't intend to wake him. I says, what do you want? She says, well, I'm the girlfriend of one of the boys that's on the boat with him, Buddy, and says, I'm in jail. She says, I want him to come down and get me out. I says, like hell he will. I said, he's not coming down to get you or anybody else out. I hung up. Well, after I hung up, I called the sergeant. And I asked him, what did they have her in there for? And he told me, said, for using obscene language and, I believe, fighting. And anyhow, I told him, I said, well, sir, don't let her call this number anymore. I said, my husband didn't put her in jail, and he certainly isn't going to get her out. I said, I feel like she needs to stay in that. So I hung up. Well, I want you to know, long about 11:30 or so, and incidentally, I had choked up with a cold and asthma. Mm-hmm. Long about 11:30 or so, the phone rang, and I said, hello, like a man, you know. And somebody says, Johnny? I said, yeah, who is it? This is Gertie. Well, I knew she was drunk, I could tell. I said, what you want? Talking like a man, you know. She says, why don't you come and pick me up? I said, tell me where you are, Gertie, and I will. She says, I'm at the cab stand, so-and-so, such-and-such a street. I said, okay, it'll be right there. I hung up. I called the police department back. I said, you can pick another one up at the cab stand. So guess who they picked up? They picked Gertie up. Well, I'd heard that Gertie would fight a man, like she knocked the constable out the door. And when I first met her, I thought, oh, Lord have mercy, she knows that was me, and I know the shrimp has told her. But she never said anything to me about it. She always treated me nice. So I figured I owed them one reason I went and talked to the judge. But they did get her.
Well, a minute ago you were talking about how the road to Mayport was different. What was the community like when you first moved down here anyway, compared to now?
It was, I'm going to tell you the truth, the community was almost like one great big family. They, now our school, we was we were very proud of that school, you know, that's where the Marine Science place is now. But we had, we were told for our, for the number of people we had there and PTA members, that we had one of the best PTAs, because when we put anything on, like a dinner, supper, what have you, we went out and got all the ingredients ourselves from different people. Oh, I was president of the PTA two times, and I'd even come hit the beach and hit the merchants for door prizes. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And we had a good little fund, you know, in our PTA treasury. We sure did. I was proud of that. And I tried to be in everything that I could. I really did, you know. I participated in school functions especially. And people were so kind to me after John died. I made a promise then that if I could ever hold my hand out and help people, I would. Mm-hmm. And I've done that when I could. There have been times when I could not. But when I could, I've done that, and I'm glad that I lived that way. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Because rank strangers that didn't even know us, they sent money. And I remember almost like it was yesterday, sitting on my couch and having people come in with food, with clothing. Because that was eight children, one pregnant woman, another wife, and then Sweet Pea, who wasn't married. Sweet Pea helped his mother take care of his mentally retarded brother. Good boy. And these people that was bringing all that in, I would parrot, just like a parrot, I'd say, thank you very much. Thank you very much. But you know what I wanted to really say? Why did it take him dying for this to happen? Well, I found out that's the way a community is. Mm-hmm. That's the way the majority of people are. That's the way I was brought up.
Yeah, must be. Well, who knows?
Yeah, ain't it? Where are we?
Well, we're talking about when you first moved to Mayport and the way the people treated you, I think.
They were real good to me. I know one thing. I learned to love them in nothing flat. It didn't take me any time at all. And I believe the majority of them like me. And that includes the black people, too. Mm-hmm. Now, we had the Gavigans had a cook, Eloise. She was in the Gavigan family, I guess, for 30 or 40 years. Mr. and Ms. Gavigan got married in 1905, incidentally, over at New Berlin. Mm-hmm. And I used to absolutely be fascinated at the tale she would tell, plus him. But especially her, she was quite a storyteller, and that's the only time she could keep my attention. But
What made them move to Mayport?
Mr. Gavigan's mother, Miss Fanny.
Yeah.
She owned a grocery store there. As a matter of fact, she owned a hotel at one time.
Hmm. In Mayport?
In Mayport. Yeah. And I want you to know, during the fishing season, she'd have people from as far as Atlanta, physicians, attorneys, so forth, come to that hotel. And she let them eat. It was bed and board, mm-hmm. you know, room and board. And I know they told a tale on one lady taking a whole dish of fried shrimp out one time, and mm-hmm. she skidded and dropped the shrimp, but she picked them back up and took them all out. I bet that happens in a lot of restaurants. But Mr. Gavigan's mother owned the home that was built there. Beautiful home. I had a picture of it in one picture, but I must not have brought it, I don't guess.
What part of the community was that in?
Do you know where Parsons Restaurant is now? You know, the parking lot across from it?
Yeah.
Right by it. That whole, they owned that whole block.
Oh, yeah.
As a matter of fact, when John was lost, I was living right across the street in the parking lot in a house that was torn down for that parking lot. I was living in one of their, Mrs. Gavigan's houses.
Mm-hmm.
She also, that parking lot little area over on the, you know, like you face a restaurant this way, and the one over here, mm-hmm. that was Ms. Gavigan's property, too. She had, and that's where we lived when we first got there. She had a two-story apartment building. Mm-hmm. She owned that, too, and then she owned another house up by the schoolhouse. As a matter of fact, she owned quite a bit of property then. Mm. And Mr. Gavigan died in 1956. Well, Mrs. Gavigan, none of the children wanted to keep because you couldn't keep her longer time. I'm going to tell you the truth, and I don't mean any disrespect towards it. It was just hard. Mm-hmm. So my son, Johnny, would spend the night with it at night, and he did that up until when John was lost. And after John was lost, I wanted him home. Mm-hmm. And then they had to get towards the, she died after I married Lou. But they had to get someone there to stay with her. She would go and visit one for a while and come home. She'd want to come home because she did have a pretty home. Mm-hmm. And the children, she left no will. Mr. Gavigan left no will. And she didn't leave a will. And the children, I don't know what happened. I really and truly don't, because when she died, I was a marginal. But I think they let the house, before they could decide on who was to get what, I just think they let it go to pot, which mm-hmm. is sad to me. Mm-hmm. I don't have hardly anything in this world materialistically. I feel like I'm the richest person in the world in blessings. Mm-hmm. But I've made a will, believe it or not, because I couldn't stand, if I thought my children were going to be like a bunch of vultures, I couldn't stand it. Yeah. I haven't taught them to be that way.
I think it's a smart thing for anyone to do.
Yes, I agree with you. And as I say, I don't have anything like materialistically, really and truly, but I don't care. But as I said, as John had lived, I'm sure I'd still be married to him because I loved him with all my heart and soul. Our wedding anniversary that year, believe it or not, was on Easter Sunday, the 21st of April mm-hmm. of 1957. And that was the day that the pilot of the first plane from the Naval Air Station came to talk to Buell and I. And believe it or not, his name was the same name as my maiden name, Mr. Cox. Hmm. I'll never forget that. And he did more talking to Rhodes's brother, Buell's brother-in-law, her husband's brother, than he did to us, because neither she nor I could take too much of it. Mm-hmm. And Beulah's baby was born in May after this happened, on May 8th after this happened, March 7th or March 8th when they were in trouble. I say May 8th, it might have been the 9th or the 10th. Yeah, yeah. But I wasn't supposed to take her to the hospital. Her friend was to take her. And her mother was with her. Her mother had one leg because she had been in a train, had cut one of her legs off. Mm. She was not from Mayport, by the way. And her mother was staying with until the baby was born. Well, that poor woman came to my house, it was late at night, to see if I could take her, because the girl that was supposed to take her to the hospital, she had an emergency call. A brother of hers was very ill and had to leave. Mm-hmm. And I had a little old 1950 Ford at that time, onion skin tires, very little. Come out and get some air. Yeah, she isn't here either.
End of side one of tape one of the July 26, 1986 interview with Geraldine Marjoram and John Gavigan Jr. Interview continued on side two. This is the start of side two of tape one of the July 26, 1986 interview with Geraldine Marjoram and John Gavigan Jr.
Where were we?
I'm Let's see. I'm going to try to remember now. Were you talking about
to my world.
About the lady getting you to take her to the hospital.
Yeah. Well, here come this poor one-legged mother. Real late at night, 12 o'clock, and that's late for me.
Yeah.
And I asked me to take her. Well, I had to go back over in what we call the hills, where the colored people live, to get this girl, Lorraine, to come and stay with my children.
Mm-hmm.
Then I had to go and wake Beulah's mother-in-law up to come to her house to stay with her two. And here I am on that little old 1950 Ford with the onion slick tires, very little gasoline, and we're going Mayport Road, and Beulah gripped the steering wheel of my car when a pain hit her, and I knew I would never, never get her to Jacksonville in time. You had to go to Jacksonville then.
Mm-hmm.
We didn't have Memorial Hospital. We didn't have Beaches Hospital. So you know what I did? I went to the police station at Jacksonville Beach. And I went in there and told them what was happening. Well, just as they got to my car, Beulah's water broke. And I remember her, they called Dr. Scott. I had called him too, incidentally. I'd stopped and called him. Well, he was at the hospital, and the policeman didn't know he was there. They didn't ask me. So they called another Dr. Cone to come. But before Dr. Cone got there, they had an ambulance there, and as they put Buell in the ambulance, that baby was born. And there were two policemen with her. And I can remember, before they put in the ambulance, she was laying in the seat of my car, and she was begging me to get roads for her. And I know I was patting her face, and my tears were falling on her face, and I said, I wished I could get him for you. I said, but he's here with you. I said, he knows what's going on. And as they put her into the ambulance, little Rhodes was born.
Hmm.
And I remember this great, big, old, tall, 6 foot, 4 inch tall SP. That's what they call the Navy Shore Patrol. He was standing there with me, and big tears were coming down his cheeks. He says, my wife says, we've got two, so she will never have another child. He says, I can't stand the thoughts of her listening to that girl, and I can't stand the thoughts of her having to go through something like this, which could happen.
Mm-hmm.
We never know.
Mm-hmm.
But later, we were having a shower for her, incidentally, Buell, at the hospital that very night at the Mayport School, and
mm-hmm.
here she was in the hospital because Rhodes came ahead of time.
Mm-hmm.
And anyhow, later on that day, I heard that Dr. Scott was absolutely furious at the Jacksonville Beach Police Department, and that he had called Chuck Franks, who was chief of police then, and raised Cain with him about not being called. Well, I took it upon myself to go by that police station, and I told Mr. Franks, I said, never have I seen two more nicer policemen, more gentler, more kind, and the way they tried to preserve some of Beulah's modesty, just how good they were with her.
Mm-hmm.
I said, Mr. Franks, please don't do anything to them. Don't say anything harsh to them. I said, be proud of them. And I really, because I saw that, I know.
Mm-hmm.
And he told me, says, I know Doug Scott. Says, I'm not going to say a word. He said, but I appreciate you coming by. And when that baby was a month old, that's the first place we took him to see those policemen. We certainly did.
Hmm.
And as I say, Beulah, she told me one time that she would never remarry. So the thoughts of another man just absolutely repelled her at that time. And I said, Beulah, I said, I pray that I can get married again. I says, I don't know who in the world it would be, but I pray that I can get married again. Well, I don't remember how she met Tom, her husband, but I do know. Upstairs, Shine and Mary Jane Barlow lived up there. They were not Mayport people. Shine was in the Navy.
Mm-hmm.
And he brought Tom to see Beulah. And Beulah liked him. Well, I had met, he brought I don't know how many for me to meet. and I didn't like them. I'd size them up and tell them I had to go, or I'd meet them at Beulah's house, and they'd introduce me. And so finally, Tom says, well, I've got one more friend that's at Green Cove Springs. I'll bring him. And it was Lou, my present husband. And I don't know. Now, here you can imagine a Tar Heel and a Mayport cracker meeting a North Dakota farm boy. We were just as different as day and night. Mm-hmm. He's quiet. I'm a big mouth. And anyhow, I met him, and I liked him from the very first minute I met him. Some reason or other, I guess he treated me the way I wanted to be treated. A widow has a tough lot, even back then. I was young, and believe you me, even well-meaning people, she still has a tough road to hoe, believe me. Just a minute.
Oh, Jesus.
Where were we?
I'm talking about meeting Mr. Marjoram.
Oh. I met him that night down at Tom and Beulah's, and I sat and talked with him, I guess, for 2 hours. And believe it or not, Beulah and I live within a block of each other. And I let him walk me home, and he asked me for a date for the next Friday night. I told him, okay. So, in the meanwhile, my vice president of the PTA came to me the next week. She said, Jerry, I hear you're going to get married again. And this was 8 months after John was lost, or 8.5 months. And I felt so guilty. I says, where did you hear that? She says, well, I just heard it. And I thought, oh, my goodness. Well, I called Beulah. I says, Beulah. We both had phones put in after this, so we'd be talking at 4 o'clock in the morning. I said, Beulah, I said, I'm not going to date Lou, I'm sorry. I said, now, just because I've been outdated him one time and word gets out that I'm going to get married, I felt guilty. So you know what I did the next weekend? I took my children and went to see the first Elvis Presley movie. I forget, Jailhouse Rock, I think was the name of it. And when I had to come back by Beulah's house, because it was only one road out of Mayport, which you know, in and out. And I came back by her house with the lights off. I made the children go in my house with no lights turned on. And we went to bed. And I hadn't been in bed 15 or 20 minutes when a rap come to my window. Jerry? Jerry, it was Beulah. I know you're in there. You're going to let me in or I'll stay out here all night. So I went and I let her in. She told me, says, you should be ashamed of yourself. Said he had on a white shirt and a tie. He was going to take you out to dinner and to a movie. Says, what do you care what the people say? Blah, 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 you know. And I really felt guilty. And I says, well, I says, he can come to my house and sit here for 1 hour, and that's it. And then he's going to have to go. He came. I don't have to put up with me. I really don't. But I liked him again so much. Well, he spent the night with Shine and Mary Jane Barlow upstairs. And I dated him Saturday, and from then on, that was the only man that I dated after John died. And I would have married him before I did, but he had bought a new car 1 month before he met me. And he was determined he was going to have that car paid for before he took on a woman with five children. And he liked one payment when he married me. He had one more payment left.
That's not bad.
But I would have married him sooner. We got married in September 30th, 1959. And I never have regretted marrying him, although there have been times that I would like to volunteer him for a moonshot many a time.
I think that happens with any couple.
I think so. But he's certainly been real good to all of us. And the children, they were glad. If I looked at anybody else while we were engaged for 2 years, if I looked at anybody else, well, almost 2 years, they would really get mad at us. I had a cousin living with me, and she was married, and you'd have thought that I was the one that was married, and she was single because she didn't let it, he was on the Roosevelt.
Yeah.
It didn't stop her from going. I threw her out of my house because I just didn't believe in that. I could not. Nowadays, what do you do?
Yeah.
I've learned a whole lot. I think you have to. I don't think you ever get too old to learn. So I just go along with What any person does, it's their own bag, it isn't mine.
Mm-hmm. I was wondering how your husband John learned about fishing.
That's the strangest thing. He worked with the government engineers. He was working with them when I married him. Of course, he was born in Mayport. And he grew up around it, but his mother sure didn't want him to fish. Now, his daddy could have cared. Anything that made the children happy was fine with him. Mm-hmm. And John, after he come back from the service, as I say, he was in New Guinea for 27 months. And he was not exactly shell-shocked, but he had not put his complete time in. Mm-hmm. Back then, I forget what the time was when they drafted him. As a matter of fact, you ever heard of a V-letter?
No.
I've got V-letters he sent to me during World War II. They're about this big.
Yeah.
They were photographed.
Yeah.
That's where they sent them back then, and they called them V-letters. Mm. And I have some for my children. I've got them in a little old cedar chest that John won a box of candy in the cedar chest on a punch board and brought it home to me. But he got out of the service before he was supposed to because of his nerves. He went back with the government engineers because he was furloughed from them when he was drafted. And he stayed with them for as long as he could. And finally, his nerves just wouldn't let him stay any longer. And the times that he would tell me about fishing, that he said that he felt so free out there, and he said so close to God. And I knew he believed like I did. He would pray. He said, I'd pray for you and my babies and for Dad and Mom and for my sister and my brother. He had one brother and three sisters. He said, I'd pray for them. And he said, and I'd ask for a safe trip back home, and says, and then the first thing I do when we get in, I give thanks to the Lord. Well, I was so glad he'd told me this, because believe it or not, Rhodes was an atheist, Beulah's husband. Mm-hmm. He thought you were born and that was it, that you were just born.
Mm-hmm.
But I wasn't brought up to believe that way, and then again, everybody to their own thing. And I felt sorry for Beulah. The fact that John had seen all of his babies and she was having this child. And that's another thing that helped me to survive, to hold my hand out to her. We had never been close friends before that, real close friends. But we certainly became close friends. And after I wrote the letter to Congressman Bennett, and she knew that I had, and then he gave me the advice he did, she went with me to the attorneys.
Mm-hmm.
And she was in on everything then. And we remained close friends until she left. They moved to California. Before Lou and I were married, they moved to California before 1959.
Mm-hmm.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. Now, John started learning about fishing after the war then?
After the war. Mm-hmm. That was to really commercially fish. It was after the war.
Mm-hmm.
And he loved it. He loved every bit of it. And I can remember Mrs. Storms that lived here at the beach, she started the First Episcopal Church at Jacksonville Beach, as a matter of fact. And everybody that walked into the house in the days preceding when the boat was in trouble,
mm-hmm.
the poor mother, their headquarters was John's sister's house, more or less, but she would greet everybody with the fact, I don't know why John wanted to fish. There have never been any fishermen in my family. Never. And finally, Miss Storms had heard it enough that she was her sister,
mm-hmm.
and she says, my dear sister, have you forgotten that our Lord was a fisherman? So then she kind of quieted down a little bit, because he loved fishing. Just like those shrimpers do. They love it. And they are good people. You never heard tell of anybody in Mayport back then getting into trouble except unless they got drunk in a fight.
Mm-hmm.
There were no robberies. There were no break-ins. There were no all the viciousness that's going on now. There was none of that.
Mm-hmm.
This Bo Wiley, who was Rhodes's brother, Part Andrew, who's in St. Augustine now. I can remember a tale that got around, and this was the actual truth. the boys would fight among themselves, and they'd been out drinking one night. And the next morning, Pard wakes Bo Wiley's mother up and says, she comes to the door and says, "Miss Jeanette, is Bo up yet?" And she said, "No." He says, "Well, here's his teeth I knocked out last night." But they were friends.
He was being polite there.
Yes, he took the teeth he knocked out back to him, you know. And even though they'd get into, like I say, when they do their, they worked hard. That shrimping's a hard life. But they played hard. And I'm telling you, it was one for all and all for one. That's what it was with those men. I've got fond memories of Mayport. I always will have. I don't go there too much now because it's Jacksonville. Mm-hmm. You know that. Jacksonville sucked it up.
Yeah.
Of course, I think the people, I don't know whether they're more aware of the police being around. I don't know whether they have more police. Do the police go there much now?
I don't
do you know
about that. I don't really know. Yeah.
And then, like, I'm sure you've, have you talked to any of the PACs?
I'm trying to get a hold of Gerald Pack.
Yeah, you know? Gerald's a good boy. Yeah. I knew the whole family. As a matter of fact, his father took John and I to get married.
Hmm.
We got married in McClenny.
Oh, yeah.
The jumping off place. Oh, Kit, take these keys to John. But Gerald, he's a good boy. He made it good. He worked hard. And the whole family has.
Mm-hmm.
They had a bunch of kids. And they got some fine people there. I'm not kidding you. I'll never forget them. Like I say, some of the happiest times of my life were spent right there in Mayport.
Well, what was it like coming from North Carolina, where the way of life was probably different, and being a fisherman's wife? What did that represent?
I wouldn't have cared if John had been a garbage man. Yeah. I loved him, and I wanted to be there. But the hardest thing in the world for me to get used to, if you want to know the truth, was that sulfur water. Have you ever drank sulfur water?
No.
Have you ever smelled sulfur water?
Yeah.
It smells like rotten eggs.
Oh, yeah.
But, believe it or not, it was healthy for you. And I adapted to that life easily because, I love John. And just life without him, I mean, life with him would have been where he was. I don't care if he'd have said we're going to the North Pole. I would have gone.
Mm-hmm. Were there certain types of chores that you had to do or ways of helping him or running the house that were different because he was a fisherman?
Take care of his babies and have him a good hot meal and keep his clothes clean and keep his babies clean.
Mm-hmm.
That was the main thing.
Did you help with fishing in any way?
No, sir. I don't remember. I did not know too much about that.
Yeah.
And this very dear person that used to work for the ice plant now, Henry was drafted during World War II because they tell me then they'd feel of you to see if you were warm and take you. And Henry had no business being in the Army, but he was in the Army. And I remember him during mullet season. I didn't know what a mullet was. And he brought me 6 great big huge fish that had sand on.
Mm-hmm.
God, I thanked him, you know, and as soon as he left, I put those fish in a bag and I went right across the street to the judge and I said, "I don't want these fish. There must be something wrong with them. They're dirty." Well, the men were beach fishing. And Mr. Gavigan laughed. He said, "Jerry, I'll take all of these you bring to me," because he loved mullet. And I did not know what a mullet was. But I'm going to tell you one thing. I believe they were the last mullet I ever gave away because I learned to like them, too. And the roe. I loved roe.
Hmm.
Now, that's one thing I was not used to. Because fish we got, we lived inland. Oxford's in the northeastern part of North Carolina, mm-hmm. and we were not on the coast. And the only kind of fish we got were in a can, mostly, like sardines, etc.
Mm-hmm.
And I did not care for fish. And Mr. Gavigan could cook a fish chowder that was so good. He was a marvelous cook. John could cook. Johnny can cook. But... And Kevin's not bad, but he's a pretty good, that's the youngest boy, the one you met.
Right.
He's a pretty good cook, but Mr. Gavigan was a marvelous cook. Mrs. Gavigan, I want you to know that they were celebrated their 50th wedding anniversary in 1955. And up until about three months before they celebrated their wedding anniversary, every morning of her life, when she woke up, her signal was to take her vanity stool and hit on the floor, upstairs floor like this. That was Mr. Jim's signal to get Miss Jeanette's breakfast ready and serve it to her in her bed. But he wanted it that way. Mm-hmm. He spoiled her. When he married her, first married her, he spoiled her, and he kept on doing it. And he took her breakfast every morning that he was living until he got sick.
Wow.
And I used to drive him to the doctor. They operated on him in June, and he lived in the fall in February of 1956. This was June of 55. And I was pregnant with Shelley, my baby. And I'd have to drive him. He had to get a B12 shot once a week. And I'd take him to Dr. McKay here at the beach. And it got to where I couldn't hardly fit my old stomach on the steering wheel, you know. But I can remember so many times going along. He had a habit of doing this. And he'd look at me and he'd say, "Jerry, I don't know what we'd do without you." And that's all I ever wanted from him. I really and truly loved him because he was a good man. Mm-hmm. You know they named a road out there by that Oak Harbor School after him, do you not?
No, I wasn't aware of that.
There is a Gavigan Road. When they named that Gavigan Road, Ish Brandt was superintendent of schools then. Mm-hmm. He's the mayor of Neptune Beach now. Mm-hmm. And he called John's sister. She's dead and gone now, but he called her and told her that he had proposed that it be named Gavigan Road. Because when Mr. Brandt first came to the beaches area, Mr. Gavigan took him around, introduced him. He got him to join the Lions Club and so on. And they did name Gavigan Road after him.
Very nice.
Yeah, I wish he was living because he could really tell you some tales about the rum runners. I wished I could remember them. I know Mrs. Gavigan told me about when she was dating him, living over in New Berlin. And she had a group there. She could play the piano. And they were singing songs, and somebody decided they were hungry, and they wanted some chicken and dumplings. And she says, "Well, Jim, you go get the chicken now, and I'll fix the chicken and dumplings." And he says, be back. Well, anyhow, to make a long story short, she fixed the chicken and dumplings, just delicious, and come to find out he'd killed one of their chickens, and she didn't know it, you know, until years later.
Yeah.
She didn't know it. And then Mr. Gavigan's mother, her name was Miss Fanny. Of course, she was dead before I ever married John. And she used to, as I say, own that store. Well, she had plenty of jewelry, diamonds mostly. That's what she liked. And I said there were three girls. There were four girls, and all the girls got diamond rings. She started with the oldest one, gave her the most expensive one, went on down. Mm-hmm. And I don't know what happened to the other. There used to be tales going around that she had money buried somewhere. Whether she did or not, we never found any of it. I never looked for any, as a matter of fact. But she used to go into Jacksonville. There used to be a restaurant there called Bernie's Restaurant. It was a famous restaurant. I can remember driving to North Carolina back then on Highway 17 because we didn't have any of the interstates. Mm-hmm. And coming back from North Carolina to come back to Florida, I'd see this man in green. Did you ever hear that restaurant where the man in green?
No.
He had a little dog, a little bulldog named Peggy, and there was this sign of him with a green suit on. And it was him, a pure cutout billboard sign. And with the little dog on a leash, well, she would go to his restaurant, and they tell me when she'd walk in there, she'd take two of the girls at a time, two one time, two another time, completely outfit them. She did business with the Furchkuts, the people that owned Furchkuts and all that. They said when she'd walk in Bernie's restaurant, it was just like a feast, was sit right in front of her like a banquet for Miss Fanny.
Mm-hmm.
Because she would do business with them. She'd outfit the girls two and three times a year. Completely spend bukus of money on them. What was a lot of money back then. And as I say, she made good with her little grocery store. Well, Mr. Gavigan ran the grocery store after she died for a long time. He serviced a lot of the pogie boats. Mm-hmm. You know, they had a pogie plant there at one time.
Now, who ran that? You were telling me about that a little while.
Billy Gaskins. He came from North Carolina to run that pogie plant. Mm-hmm. And now that's another thing that smells bad. And to tell you the truth, they tell me they make cosmetics out of some of the stuff that they did with those pogies, whatever. But now Billy Gaskins did, he was head of that pogie plant at one time.
What was the name of that plant? Do you remember?
Oh, gosh, no. He didn't own it. He ran it. He was the manager. They'd get their groceries for the pogie boats there. And I can remember so many times coming into Mayport. Oh, that smell, you know. And John would always say to me, it smells like money to me. He would always say that. And I'd like the sulfur water. And, you know, no one was ever sick to amount to anything in Mayport. Kevin did get spinal meningitis before John died. He was on the Molly and Me with Mr. Liam Canova, and they had to bring him home, but we sure got him back all right, thank goodness.
Now, explain to me about the sulfur water. What was that about?
The Mayport water system, Aline Hirth owned it. And this sulfur water, unless you have ever drank it, you can't imagine what I'm talking about. When you drank it, it tasted good if you didn't have to smell it. I used to do it this way. My nephew, to show you how bad it was, he would visit me and brush his teeth in RC Cola. And it smelled bad. It had a rotten egg smell about it. But it was good for you. It was healthy. But he couldn't convince me of that, even though I had to put up with it. Yeah. I used to bathe, and I'd think, oh, God, am I clean? I didn't even think I was clean. But, of course, the people that live there, they're used to it. I guess they're still getting sulfur water there. I don't know.
Can you hear a noise? Yeah. That's a signal that there are only 5 minutes of tape left here. See, look.
Oh, dear.
And that means I'm going to put another tape on pretty soon. And this is just see that light? A warning light and a buzzer. Okay? So, I'm glad you mentioned that. That's okay.
But I did adjust to the sulfur water. I had to, because I like water, you know.
And yeah.
I more or less had to. But now, having been away from it as long as I have, it would be hard for me to drink it, I do believe. Because, like I say, if you couldn't smell it, you'd be all right. But I'd hold my nose. I learned. I remember my brother came to visit me, and the first time he came, and he told me that I should be ashamed of myself to give that sulfur water to my children. And the first Gator Bowl game that they had in Jacksonville, my brother and my cousin came down. My redhead brother and redhead cousin came down to attend it. Wake Forest and South Carolina were playing. And John and I, they had tickets for us, and we went. And those two fools, my brother and my cousin, were pulling for Wake Forest naturally. And lo and behold, Wake Forest was behind, and they had their money. I don't think they were too strict then, betting. And they were taking Wake Forest. I don't remember what the bet was. I was holding the money. Guess who won? Wake Forest. Sure did. And I wouldn't have bet on them. I wouldn't even bet a nickel on them at that particular time that they were making the money, you know. But John and I did go to the first Gator Bowl game. And that was January 1st. They had it on the first day of the new year instead of the way they do it now, 1946.
We could just turn that over now.
Okay.
End of side 2 of tape 1. Interview continued on side 1 of tape 2.